It is the most common learning disability in children. We explore dyslexia today in the Upper Cumberland. About 1 in 10 people are dealing with dyslexia. That's more than 40 million U.S. adults, but only about 2 million know that they have dyslexia. They may know something is different in the way they read, but they may not understand why. Today, insight into dyslexia from members of the Tennessee branch of the International Dyslexia Association, Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel from Vanderbilt University, and Alexis Boucher from the University of Tennessee. It is the most common learning disability in children. We explore dyslexia today in the Upper Cumberland. About 1 in 10 people are dealing with dyslexia. That's more than 40 million U.S. adults, but only about 2 million know that they have dyslexia. They may know something is different in the way they read, but they may not understand why. Today, insight into dyslexia from members of the Tennessee branch of the International Dyslexia Association, Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel from the University of Tennessee, and Alexis Boucher from Vanderbilt University. Michelle, let's start with a definition. When we say dyslexia, what do we mean?
Well, we're talking about a neurological thing that happens in the brain. So it is cognitive. It is not visual. And what it is part of the language processing. And it has to do with, like, having struggles with sounds and letters and associating sounds with the letters. So in understanding and in recognizing that. And then it also can affect how you're spelling and so pulling up a memory of letter formation and what a letter looks like to correspond with the sound that you hear. So it's a lot of sounds and letters, but it's not a visual. Do either one of you want to chime in?
Yeah. I often think about it as a difficulty with reading words and often spelling words. It doesn't mean you can't spell or read words. It just means you need to work a little bit harder, but you can get there.
Alexis, how does it most often show up in the average person?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking at a younger age, we can try and have students sort of identify individual sounds in words. If I said the word cat, what's that first sound you hear? And it's the ability to sort of relate sounds, and so printed English and spoken English, so that you are able to read the words or spell the words. What we tend to see when they're younger is issues identifying unique individual sounds contributing to a word. When they're a little bit older, we can often see it through difficulties reading and writing, even single syllable words.
I've heard people say, Samantha, that when they look at word, it looks like a jumble. Do you hear that often in your work?
Yeah, I have heard that. And I think that's one of those pieces where sometimes we don't have the language to really figure out exactly what might be happening. And so that idea of the words being jumbled actually relates a little bit more to this ability to kind of coordinate what we're seeing with what we're hearing, with what language we know and the meanings of those words, and bringing it together in a meaningful way within our brain. And so what feels jumbled is really just thinking about the order of that visual input, those letters that we see, and the sounds that we know they make. And that can translate when a kid's talking about it as words being jumbled, but it doesn't necessarily represent words being jumbled from a visual perspective. Because as Michelle sort of spoke about, this isn't a visual need. This really does stem from this language-based need at the word and reading and spelling level, and how that might impact things like fluency, how smoothly we read when we read a passage.
I imagine what might be difficult for a parent, let's say, is that my child hears the words and understands what a cat is or what a dog is. It's the reading part that can sometimes be an issue. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think how I like to think about it is, say the word is WAS, W-A-S. And the student knew how to read it yesterday. Today we present them with the same word and they say saw. What we need to give them credit for is that they got all the same letters. What they need is more repeated exposure and practice opportunities with a skilled reader to also sort of retain the letters in the right order. So it's about really kind of retaining that whole image and not just the letters in any order. So that's why we tend to see that, which as if you can imagine as somebody with dyslexia, it can be very frustrating because you know that you know what you're doing, but you just need a chance to, you need a couple more exposures than maybe a typically developing reader.
And I would say that to the benefit of a parent or a kid that can say, I know that word and what it means when I'm not having to read it. That's a strength. And I think that's where we can build background knowledge and oral language in a way that at that point, once a child has the phonics-related skills to decode or spell those words, they can draw upon their amazing language comprehension or word meaning understanding to be able to then make meaning of what they're reading. And that's where those two things can be different, understanding what a word means versus being able to translate what's written into how we read that.
We're talking about dyslexia, and as we move through our conversation, we'll also let you know about resources that are available to you if you're a parent, maybe your child could be dealing with some of these issues. Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, and Alexis Boucher are our guests. Samantha, just grab the, there you go. That way, it sounds a little better. The Tennessee branch of the International Dyslexia Association is our topic today. Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, and Alexis Boucher. Samantha is a professor at Vanderbilt, Alexis at the University of Tennessee. So what do we know about what causes dyslexia?
I mean, for starters, it's genetic. There's a genetic component to it. I think what it's often confused as being a cause of really just relates to how strong was the instruction the student received in the first place. It's important to rule that out. If we're moving out of sort of a phase of reading instruction where we sort of went away from phonics for a bit, teaching kids that letters and sounds relate to each other. And by doing that, we've got some cleaning up to do now to really help kids get back on pace. So I think making sure kids have been adequately taught the relations between letters and sounds and that their seeing and their hearing is as is typically developing so that we can rule out some of these things. But I know there's definitely a genetic component that that geneticists have traced.
Samantha, does it come down to starting out ruling out other things that may be involved?
Yes. So at its core, dyslexia does have that rule out factor. So you have to rule out the idea of instruction that hasn't been matched to what that child needs. You have to rule out these other competing potential diagnoses. Dyslexia really is an unexpected underachievement at the word reading or word spelling level. So every other piece of data we might have would suggest this child should be reading okay. And that child still has some difficulties at the word reading level that we need to address. And that unexpectedness, by ruling out all those other competing diagnoses, lets us kind of drill down into figuring out this is dyslexia at play. And we have strategies to support a kid who is dyslexic based on that.
Michelle, we're talking about children, but is dyslexia something that people deal with throughout their lives?
Yes. There is no cure for dyslexia. Can it be improved? Absolutely, through proper instruction. And there's a wealth of knowledge behind research and what are best practices for teaching a person who has dyslexia. And with proper intervention, improvements, in reading accuracy and being able to actually read the words accurately, some fluency can improve the rate in which they're reading. But dyslexia itself, the part that's in the brain that Alexis mentioned, there's a genetic component that research has found. that never goes away. So yes, you can be 100 years old and still have dyslexia.
Does it impact the desire to read? Does it for a lot of children, for example, does it become such a problem that they don't want to read?
100%. Not at its core. Every kid wants to read. The trouble is really when you have repeated experience of something not working right. I think about something I'm horrible at, throwing darts. My partner is great at throwing darts. And I am so horrendous, I just eventually give up wanting to go and throw darts anymore because it's not motivating to do something I'm really bad at and not seeming to get better despite all of my efforts to throw that dart at that dartboard. And it's a similar sort of logic where decreased motivation can occur when we have repeated experiences of failure. And that can be really devastating to a child, to their self-image, to their understanding of who they are as a reader and what that means, to their belief in what that means about how capable they are.
And there's this idea of a Matthew effect where the better you are at reading, the better you'll continue to get. And the more challenging reading is for you, the more challenging it will continue to be, to the point where there ends up being really an achievement gap. Because as you engage in reading, you are growing the number of words that you can instantly recognize by sight, and you are building background knowledge and vocabulary and all of these things that in concert work together to help you accurately read a text. So it's not just about it being frustrating. It's about that the exposures to print and the interactions with print are less efficient and less productive to really enhancing reading skills over time. So Yeah, I think the best way to put it is less productive practice opportunities. They really need the support of a skilled reader and really evidence-based instruction to guide their growth.
Has there been an understanding of dyslexia in schools? I'm sure it's there now, but in historic path, I mean, was it just, come on, you don't know how to read? Or, you know, did we understand, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
I think the body of research that we have now has come a long way, and there's an entire body of research that is the science of reading, and if you Google search that, you'll see a wealth of information that comes up from that. The definition of dyslexia, or actually the label, rather, of dyslexia has actually changed over the years. It was originally called word blindness. So even the label over historical, significance has changed. And I think there has been slow to actually get into the classroom trenches, so to speak. And I think there has been mislabeling of, well, you're just not applying yourself enough. So, I mean, I think those labels have been placed on children who have dyslexia, but I do think there's research out there, and I think it is making its way into the classroom. I know our organization has worked with legislators to help get some legislation in the state of Tennessee. We set on the Reading 360 Early Literacy Board for the state. We also set on the Dyslexia Advisory Council Board for the state. So, I mean, I think there's a movement to get this information into the classrooms.
And I guess it's for a lot of people, even as the three of you are explaining it, it's hard to comprehend. It's hard as someone who reads to understand what that person is seeing and what they're not seeing. So I guess that's part of it that can be difficult. We're talking with Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, and Alexis Boucher as we continue talking about the issue of dyslexia. Michelle Richter is our guest. She is with the Tennessee branch of the International Dyslexia Association, also Alexis Boucher and Samantha Gessel. So
What are the resources that are available? What do you do when you find out, Michelle, that this is happening with your child? How do you bring resources to bear?
Well, in the public school system, there is a whole entire procedure set in place where there's universal screeners. And then if a child shows characteristics of dyslexia, then there's a whole entire pathway that happens in the public school system for that. But even if you're homeschooling your child, even children that are homeschooled or children that are in private education can still receive help from the public school system. Not everybody is aware of that or knows that. And there is something called Child Find, and you can even go to your public school system, even if you're homeschooled or in private education, and have the public school system actually test your child. But then the other resources are, there is a whole entire body of intervention that is multi-modality, multi-sensory based, that is very systematic, very diagnostic, and there are multiple intervention programs with under that body of research and knowledge. And there are practitioners and people trained in that. We're trained in it. And there are directories you can go to, and you can find these people that are trained in this particular intervention training that can work with your child. You can go to our website, 10ida.org, and there is one-page fact sheets about various questions that you might have. Middle Tennessee State University has their Center for Study and Research, and then Vanderbilt has the Kennedy Center, UTK. You want to jump in with other resources?
We have a new state-funded research center at the University of Tennessee called the Tennessee Reading Research Center. And I actually just made some infographics for teachers and parents. So my student my child has dyslexia, now what? And it sort of leads you to a lot of the resources that might be helpful to you. First of all, what is a basic working definition? Where might I find other parents that are in the same position as me? And what legally am I sort of guaranteed? What is my child guaranteed with this disability? And I think another thing that doesn't get said enough, if you are diagnosed with a learning disability in basic reading, that is dyslexia.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of times IEPs don't call it dyslexia. And so parents get confused that they're two separate things. So a learning disability, and then if the area of need is basic reading, you are in essence saying the student has dyslexia. So that's one type of learning disability.
Samantha, the road to long-term success, it's there, right? Mm-hmm. There are people that you would never know are dyslexic.
Yes, absolutely. And pardon me. I think that is where it really comes into play, where you can never be cured of dyslexia. But what really matters is building those basic foundational skills, in addition to providing the self-advocacy to know how to tap into really amazing assistive technologies that can help you. So if you think about things like voice to text or text to speech, those sorts of things can lighten what would be called the cognitive load when you are confronted with, a textbook in college, for example, where suddenly you can not have to rely as heavily on putting all of that energy forward, all that cognitive load into the word reading, that, yes, you have learned all those basic skills, but can still take a lot of effort. And you can instead reallocate all your effort to the area of understanding what you're reading about. And knowing how to advocate for those tools that can help you is a really important part for long-term success. Because, yes, there are plenty of adults highly successful who you might never know have dyslexia. And almost always, those adults will also speak to how they use day-to-day these basic tools. And in the world of technology, it's getting easier and easier to navigate a world successfully in the context of having dyslexia or without.
It's interesting because there was a group that came together at Tennessee Tech for a research symposium just a couple of weeks ago, and the topic was just that. That so many college professors, for example, if we're talking about it at that level, simply don't understand that a percentage of their students are dealing with this and are needing the technologies or needing the ways to deal with it, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah, and to that point, I think that in the world of special education, at least, there are laws in place to support transition planning. And that is true for all children across all disability categories. But I think it often what might get underemphasized for children who are identified in special education as having a specific learning disability in basic reading. So we're talking dyslexia. And perhaps that is the importance then of bolstering up those transition supports and services so that even if the college professors don't know this about their students, the students know to advocate and know how to tap into the resources that exist across college campuses from just the basic offices of disability services and accommodations.
And I know that at the college level, you have to self-disclose that you have a disability, but I do a little informal background questionnaire and lots of people come tell me they do in fact have dyslexia. And I'm usually teaching about dyslexia. So I'm like, let me know if, you know, if any of this, you know, could be better adapted to your needs to make sure that, you know, I'm practicing what I preach. But I think that becomes the advocacy piece that Samantha talked about earlier is really important to feel comfortable in reaching out and speaking up for yourself so that you get the supports you are entitled to.
And I would say to that point, there might be folks that hear that and say, but that gives an unfair advantage. And what we're talking about here are accommodations. And one of the most frequent accommodations, I'm looking around this room and two of the four of us have it visibly. We are wearing glasses. An accommodation is something that gives a differential boost. If you need it, it makes a difference and can help you shine. If you don't need it, it makes no difference at all. So those kids with dyslexia, those college students with dyslexia who might be able to have these accommodations that are going to support them and help them showcase all that they know, a college student who doesn't need that, it's not going to make a difference whether they have it or not. That's that differential boost where it makes a difference where we need it and not when we don't.
We're educating you about dyslexia as we talk about the work of the International Dyslexia Association, the branch here in Tennessee. We continue. Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, Alexis Boucher is our guest. So, a parent, when would you start to suspect something? When would the average parent start to suspect something with their child?
Well, I think one thing is that for a while, students with dyslexia can fake it till they make it. You can start to memorize words, but at some point that strategy kind of falls apart. So we call that sort of those compensation strategies. And so I think when kids are being asked to read multisyllabic words or words that have more than one syllable, you can start to see that sort of compensatory strategy fall apart a bit. So, but you can tell as early as you can do some type of speech assessment with a student and ask them about the individual units of speech in a given word. So we can start to detect this early on, but definitely by like third grade, we start to get maybe even second, just visually how they're doing reading words.
Is it going to be something that a teacher is going to be more easily able to see than just a parent, perhaps?
I'm currently speaking to a lot of parents. Vanderbilt is starting up a dyslexia school for August 2024. And so I am having a lot of conversations with a lot of families that voice their story. And often, particularly if a child is one of siblings, or perhaps the sibling has learned to read fairly with a fair amount of ease, it will show up in the parent's storytelling from the level of, you know, letters were just really hard to identify for this buddy in preschool. And it wasn't the case for my other kid, for example. And so there are some of those basic signs that a parent might pick up on and start to ask questions, even pre-literacy, before we're reading words, just being able to think about print that's in the natural environment and how a child is navigating that. Another sort of flag might be even something as basic as remembering, you know, a phone number or your address, which is something we might ask kids to do a lot when they're itty bitty, because it's a basic safety thing. And if that's a little bit trickier, parents might have a slight flag raised where right off the bat, they might be wondering some things. And then while a child is in school for the first year, perhaps a little over a year, there starts to be that rule out of instruction.
You mentioned something, and I have a friend, and I've heard this from other people, that they talk about dyslexia with numbers. Is that truly dyslexia, or is that something else going
on? Oh, I'm so glad you clarified that. That is another specific learning disability. So when we bring numbers into the mix, and particularly math, that's called dyscalculia. Yeah, and I pause
say it wrong.
Because I always struggle to get that out of my mouth. Dyscalculia. So all of the big three of specific learning disabilities are dyslexia, so a word reading difficulty, dyscalculia, difficulty in calculating, and then dysgraphia, which is difficulty at kind of the written composition level of things, writing. It's really, really tricky.
So it's in the family?
It's in the family, that umbrella of specific learning disabilities, but you don't have to have all three, and many children don't.
And so with numbers, my friend, for example, will flip the first and the last number. So that's what we're talking about. So it is in that family, perhaps.
Yeah. It could be. It's hard to know for sure, but it could be.
We don't want to diagnose her right here.
Interestingly enough, 80% of learning disabilities are dyslexia in particular. Wow. So, and it might also be due to just education. And I think dyslexia is easier to identify. I think dyscalculia, I've never had to say that out loud, and dysgraphia are a little bit less understood. So I don't think that they don't exist as high prevalence. I think as society, we need to advance our knowledge in those areas and make that part of the screening that's mandated for dyslexia.
Michelle, the work of the association in the Tennessee branch, you've mentioned that you're advocating in the legislature, you're making resources available. What else is available through the association?
Well, we have a hotline number. So on our website, we have a phone number. And there is a board member who's constantly monitoring that. So we are answering questions there for parents, and we have educators that call that hotline. I monitor the website, and so I am helping answer questions, and same thing, I get a mix of parent questions and educator questions, and so I have spent several times walking a parent through exactly what the process is. Okay, you received the characteristics of dyslexia letter. Now what do you do next? Now what do you do? And sharing our Wayne Page, pieces of infographic fact sheets with them. So we can do that. We also have an annual conference where we bring in experts in the field of literacy and structured literacy and interventions, and parents are welcomed. We have a parent track for parents as well on that conference. So we are disseminating information, sharing resources, helping to kind of walk beside parents and educators in the advocacy, part of it.
We're talking about the International Dyslexia Association and, more importantly, the work of those who are trying to help with dyslexia here in our state. Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, and Alexa Boucher are with us. Alexis Boucher, before we run out of time, what do you say to the parent who has gotten that letter that says your child may be dealing with dyslexia? What do you say to them?
I'd say, your prayers have been answered. You now know exactly how to help your child do their best academically. I really do think reading is ingrained in everything we do. And so having that classification allows you to advocate for what your kid deserves because they're a bright child. They just need specialized instruction that will really help them shine. So I would say it's a good thing because now we can help.
Samantha, there's not a cure, but with tools, with resources, your child can do whatever they want to do in whatever field they want to do.
That's exactly right. And I think for some families, it doesn't feel like that at first when they first get that identification label. But with time and with digging and with the professionals to support you, I think we can get to that point. And that's not to say that you can't feel worried, because this is your baby and your baby is your world. Of course you're going to feel worried. But what that should do is light a fire to look for more info, to be able to advocate for that kiddo, and to know there are places to turn to make sure they can be successful for the rest of their lives, because they will be when given those tools.
Michelle, how do we get in touch with the Tennessee branch of the International Dyslexia Association? You have a website.
Yes, we do have a website. So 10TNIDA.org, and you type that in and you will get on our website. And then at the top, there are several different tabs up at the top, and you click on those and there's drop down menus that will take you to further resources and information. And my child is dyslexic, and so from a parent perspective, it is an emotional journey that you're on, and it's an emotional journey with any child. Any parent worries about their child, but there's so much hope, and it's not as limiting as I think it has been in the past with the research that we have available now, with the interventions that we have, and with more and more people becoming knowledgeable and trained in how to teach best practices. There's so much hope. I see it. And, as we've already stated, the accommodations, the ability to use technology to help read text that may be above your actual independent reading level at the time. I see it as hope.
She is Michelle Richter, Samantha Gessel, Alexis Boucher, members of the International Dyslexia Association, the Tennessee branch. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting us.